When I was younger, I used to love watching Boris Becker play tennis. Everyone loves Federer these days. He plays beautifully. But Boris Becker was the most exciting ever tennis player, if you ask me. And once I read his autobiography, and here he describes a moment when he's talking to his manager in a moment of reflection. "You're young. You've got millions," he said to me. This is his manager talking to him. "You've got scores of women knocking at the door. What more do you want?" And when I replied, "Substance, meaning, some sense to it all," he looked at me in pity and said, "No more." The search for meaning in what we do is natural. The philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said, "Here we are, all of us, eating and drinking to preserve our precious existence. There is nothing, absolutely no reason for existing." And the teacher in this book seems to say the same thing. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That's the theme of the book. It's there in the beginning, it's there at the end, it's there all the way through. Everything is meaningless. And the big question that he starts off with, what do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? We labor and we toil, and what gain is there? What gain is there for you at the end of a week's work? What gain is there for you at the end of a lifetime's work? You've toiled away day after day, week after week, year after year. And what do you have to show for it? What does the world have to show for it? Barry Humphreys, the man who created Dame Edna Everidge, entitled his book, More Please. And he writes this, "I always wanted more. I never had enough milk or money or socks or sex or holidays or first editions or solitude or gramophone records or free meals or real friends or guiltless pleasures or neckties or applause or unquestioning love. Of course, I've had more than my fair share of these commodities, but they always left me with a vague feeling of unfulfillment." Where was the rest? And let's be clear right at the start. This book, Ecclesiastes, is not just written for the unbeliever, for the Barry Humphreys. It's written for the believer, for you and me. It's not an apologetic talk to an unbeliever, trying to make them see the emptiness of their life, although it would be useful as that. It's a book for every man and woman, believer and unbeliever. Everyone who lives in this fallen world, or under the sun, as the teacher likes to say. Because we too want gain, don't we? We want more, don't we? We might all try to gain different things, but we're all trying to gain. Those of you who are a bit younger, what are you looking forward to gaining as you grow up? More money. Security, independence, a house, a bigger house, a nicer area, good school for the kids, the latest technology, the latest iPhone, the latest convenience, a holiday, a nicer holiday, more holidays, freedom, more friends, contentment, control, significance, success, respect, more of the things that we want in life. Aren't we all trying to gain, trying to profit from the things that we do, from our toil? Maybe as Christians, a part of us thinks that we shouldn't be aiming for those things. But if we're honest, don't our hearts strive for them? Now, the word translated meaningless in the NIV Bibles, if you've got an ESV Bible, it will be vanity. If you read the commentaries, it's a difficult word to translate. And it literally refers to a vapor, to a breath, to a mist, what is transient and passing and can't be grasped, just like you can't grasp mist. And it's such an important concept in this book, Ecclesiastes, that the teacher refers to it 38 times. But he means slightly different things depending on what he's talking about at that particular time. So sometimes he means senseless, sometimes absurd, sometimes futile, sometimes transient and passing away. Life is like a vapor. It just passes away. One moment is there and the next it's gone. Or as he says in verse 4, there's no PowerPoint, so it will be helpful if you've got it open for you on page 671. As it says in verse 4, generations come and generations go. You're here now, but the day will come when you no longer will be here. The same fate, chapter 2, verse 14, overtakes everyone, the good and the bad. We all die like vapor which passes away. That is us. That is our lives. And what do we gain if one day we will be gone? Look at the physical world, he says. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. Has anything been gained? Anything been achieved? Verse 6, look at the wind. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. Mindless repetition. The wind goes round and round. To what end? For what gain? Verse 7, all streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. The repetition in our physical world reinforces the truth that all life is a vapor. Comes and it goes. It repeats itself, but it doesn't last. Nothing is truly gained. And as Christians, we need to hear this teacher's message. Because it's a message that a part of each one of us will think and feel. Now, for some of us, the feeling will be buried deep down inside and will be scarcely recognizable. For others, it will be much closer to the surface. And we'll, these concepts, these thoughts will be very recognizable. We'll think, yes, yes, yes. A feeling of meaningless, of futility, of absurdity. What am I gaining with all my toil? Is there really any point in turning up to work tomorrow? Maybe we can join in with the teacher in verse 8. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear has its fill of hearing. Why, teacher? Why are all things wearisome? Because our eyes see and our ears hear more and more, but none of it is new. What has been will be again, verse 9. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. The teacher wrote at a time before smartphones and social media. A study a few years ago calculated that we are bombarded with 34 gigabytes of data every day. That's, so I'm told, a sufficient quantity to overload a laptop in a week's time through mobile phones, online entertainment, TV, emails, radio, newspapers, books, social media, all that kind of stuff. We receive 105,000 words, 23 words a second. But all that information that we're receiving, that we're being bombarded with each day, verse 10, is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. Sometimes the human race does get excited about what it is and what it can achieve. The website livescience.com wrote this: humans are an ingenious species. We've been on the planet a relatively short time. Modern Homo sapiens have dreamed up and created some amazing, sometimes far out things. Then it goes on to list the top 10 inventions of all time. The wheel. the nail, the compass, the printing press, the internal combustion engine, which kick-started the Industrial Revolution and enabled the invention of cars and airplanes, the telephone, the light bulb, penicillin, the internet. These incredibly useful and clever things that humans have invented over these past 1,000 years that have changed the way we live. The invention of the wheel meant that we could transport things further, do more trade, get richer quicker. Invention of the light bulb. We could go to bed later and still keep working. Get richer quicker. Penicillin. Live longer. But is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? We still toil. We still die. A generation comes, a generation goes, and in the grand scheme of things, what have we actually achieved? Verse 11, no one remembers the former generations. Even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Life is a vapor. We'll all pass away. Will we be remembered? Can you remember the name of your great grandparents? I can remember the name of one of my great grandparents. He was called Bobby, my dad's grandfather. I know virtually nothing else about him. The names of my other great-great-grandparents, I don't know. You will not be remembered. And maybe you think, well, I'm going to be someone special. I'm going to be an Alexander Fleming who discovered penicillin, or a Thomas Edison who invented light bulbs. I'm going to do something special and be remembered. I'm sure there are monuments to these people all over the world. We know their names. But frankly, who cares? Who really cares? We know their names, but what good is that to them? The same fate overtakes us all. Is the teacher trying to make us depressed? Because maybe you're thinking he's succeeding pretty well. Thank you very much. Well, yes and no. I think he's trying to get us to give voice to some of our innermost feelings, to vocalize what we may have felt in moments of doubt or depression or anxiety and fear, to be honest about what living in this broken world feels like. Not so that we become depressed, but so that we see this world for what it is. Life is fleeting. Life is a vapor. And if we look around at the world and ourselves, that is how we should feel. And so the answer is to look away from ourselves and away from our world and look to our Creator. Have a look at chapter 3, verses 9 to 14. Chapter 3, verse 9. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. Here the teacher asks that same question we saw in the beginning of chapter 1. What do workers gain from their toil? But he also points us not to our work, but to God's work. What God has done. Verse 11, have a look. He's also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Verse 14, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. We can't gain anything by what we do. But God has put eternity into our hearts so that we lift up our eyes knowing that there's more to life than what we see around us. More to life than 80 years and 10. More to life than working 9 to 5, 30, 40, 50 years. We lift up our eyes and we see what God has done, and we can't fathom what he's done from beginning to end. But the teacher says what God has done will endure forever. When it comes to our toil, there's nothing new. Nothing and no one will be remembered. But when it comes to God's work, it will endure forever. The hopelessness, the meaninglessness, the vaporousness of life in this fallen world is meant to drive us away from ourselves and the world to the one who made us. To the one who's eternal and whose work lasts forever. God does it so that people fear him. And what is the supreme work of God? It's his saving work. It's the death and the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, through which we can be born again to a new life, to an eternal life. Free from the shackles of this world. Even though right now we remain in this broken world with these broken, fallen bodies, we know that we have been made new and have a certain hope for that future. Paul writes about this new hope using the same language. Paul in Romans 8, he uses this word. This word that's been used 38 times in Ecclesiastes, which we've seen as meaningless in the NIV. Paul uses it. He calls it, let me get it right, frustration in Romans 8:20. Romans 8:20, for the creation was subjected to frustration. Same Greek word. Not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. As we lift our eyes to God and to his works which last forever, and to his Son, Jesus Christ, and to his death and resurrection, as we fear him, so we then can put our work and our toil in its true place. Chapter 3, verse 12. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. When we stop trying to gain from our labors and we fear the one who made us, then we can begin to enjoy the gift from God of our labor.